Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impacts these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Our first guest has been involved with Manifest 7 since 2014. He has been instrumental raising capital and has overseen a successful strategy to streamline operations and build its omnichannel platform to the point where the company now has conditional approval to list on the Canadian Securities Exchange. Please welcome President of Manifest 7, Mr. Urban Smedeby. Our next guest is a visionary thought leader in the tech space. He is very well known for his accomplishments in marketing technology. He created the first market mobile banking app back in 1998. And he has served as COO here at New Frontier Data for the past 3.5 years. Please welcome Mr. Gary Allen.
Thank you, Heather, for having me. And Urban, good to see you again, sir.
Good to see you too, Gary. It's been too long.
Way too long.
Well, before we dive in, Urban, do you mind just giving our listeners who aren't familiar with Manifest 7 a quick rundown of who you are, what you do?
Of course. So we started back in 2014 as an investment company. We were largely just taking minority stakes in ancillary companies. But as the industry and the legal climate got better and better, our investors wanted us to cross that green line. But we made about 15 investments. Full disclosure, New Frontier was one of them. We were on the seed round on New Frontier, but we'd also took positions in Willie's Reserve, Meadow, a few other companies that all have done pretty well. But as the industry was maturing, and this is pre-Prop 64 passing, we looked at the industry and thought this is probably ripe for a omni-channel model. And we wrote a white paper back in 16 and started migrating from the investment model to an operating model. We aligned ourselves with a family office out of Mexico City and started acquiring licenses and buildings up and down the state of California. We had the sale leaseback structure prior to MedMen Acreage. This seems to be the structure that everyone is going after now. We had that very early on. As we sit here now, we are still, you know, doing some infilling in regards to covering the entire state. But the goal is to have distribution, dispensing, and delivery, all that lines up to a 1-800-CANNABIS, which is one access point. And like I said, there's still some infilling to be done. But as we sit here now, I think we cover close to 80% of the customers in California. So we have a presence from San Diego all the way to Sacramento. And per what you just said, we're about to go public as well. We believe that the cannabis 2.0 is truly going to hit, most likely post-election. But, you know, in not necessarily discussing politics, but with all of the, you know, aid that is currently being sent out to all the unemployed people, the, you know, desperate need for additional revenue from not only the state, but the feds as well. We believe that legalization is going to rapidly move forward in the coming, you know, 12 to 18 months. And being poised and being public at that juncture is something that we have, you know, carefully orchestrated. And we should be actually up and trading here within the month of August. So that's a little bit about us.
Amazing. That's exciting.
Yeah, congratulations on that, Urban. It's been an interesting few years as we've known each other, and as we've seen the two companies grow, watching the transformation. You know, it's inspirational. You've done a really well job, if you don't mind the compliment.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Okay, well, we have a lot to cover, so we'll dive right in. Last week, Bloomberg reported LeafLink debt deal shows cannabis entering a new phase. So access to traditional financing, or lack thereof, in the industry has been an ongoing issue and has forced companies to rely on private equity. This has contributed to lack of liquidity, overemphasis on growth rather than fundamentals, and accelerated timelines for new companies to show profit in a relatively unstable market. But the latest credit facility obtained by LeafLink marks a turning point in the development of the industry as more and more lenders are tentatively extending lines of credit to select companies. So, Urban, I would love to just start with, how do you believe that the lack of access to traditional banking has really affected the growth in the industry?
That's been the bane of our existence, and I'm sure Gary will echo those sentiments. But again, per what I believe is an improving legal climate, you know, we truly thought that the SAFE banking bill was going to pass. You know, it had passed the House. You know, we were at a conference last fall. Yep. It was a Canaccord conference up in Toronto. And, you know, some of the, you know, most visible advocates had just met with Mitch McConnell. And, you know, it was moving towards, I don't know necessarily if it would have passed the Senate, but all indications were, and this is right leading up to the impeachment effort. So just about everything else died. Then subsequently, obviously, we had COVID, and now we're sitting here today. But I do believe that there's going to be, you know, improvements in the legal climate. How rapidly that will actually be instituted, I cannot speak to, but banking has been and still continues to be, you know, again, one of our biggest issues that we're still contending with on a daily basis. So, Gary, I don't know what your views are on that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I also, I would expand a bit on the banking piece as far as a bridge and or engine to legalization. And I think that the Safe Banking Act will be revisited first, you know, as you said, Urban. The ability for states and the nation to collect revenues via taxes is only going to be expedited by the capability of safe banking, by the insurance that safe banking provides, the and also the transparency of the transactions. You know, Urban, whenever we all came into the industry years ago, you know, the big question about banking was that, or the statement, I'm sorry, was that the banks could not be investigatory institutions. With the passing of the Safe Banking Act, they don't need to be, right? And also, in that, the efficiency and the creativity that has been forced upon this industry because of that has, I do also support what you said about Cannabis 2.0. It will also force the rapid succession of Cannabis 2.0 to come through after the election and as safe banking becomes law. So I couldn't agree more. And I think from every level, from every direction you look at this topic, the banking is the first foothold to legalization and will expedite. It will bring the snowball effect that everybody's been hoping for.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, speaking specifically to the impact on debt financing, how do you think the increase in availability will, you know, affect the industry landscape?
Yeah, so again, this is an environment that obviously no one has been in ever. Nothing like this has happened for 100 years. So everyone is trying to navigate this current environment. But last year, as an example of, you know, current and relevant as to what we're doing and how we're navigating it. But last year we did a, you know, close to $26 million private round. And as the fall was rolling around, we got into a subsequent round that we were actually doing. This was straight equity. And we had raised close to $4 million at 100% premium to the round that we had done previously. Also in the same year, we had financing lined up, an anchor investor lined up from Australia. And I don't know if you guys remember, but there were huge fires at the Christmas New Year, which obviously then impacted that anchor investor. And we were back on track right when COVID hit. The world ended.
Like the movie, if you can't catch a break.
No, that was, it's been, again, we joke about this, but being an executive in the cannabis industry is really just, you know, finding solutions, finding workarounds, being nimble, being able to pivot. That is the most important thing. So as we found ourselves with COVID, the equity markets absolutely just dried up completely. We again had to pivot. We then, you know, shuttered the equity round that we had, you know, raised, you know, and quite a bit of money under, and had to come up with a convertible structure. There was no appetite for equity whatsoever. So we came up with a convertible that is secured by the assets of the company, obviously. It's a coupon that is still, you know, aggressive compared to, you know, traditional, and this kind of goes to the overall climate and the ability of being able to secure debt financings. But, you know, I don't know how much you guys follow our peers. So I'm not going to name any names, but, you know, a very large company did a 60% load on a debt piece, which again, is that's as usurious as it possibly gets. So the ability to open up banking in more traditional lines is something that everyone is looking for. But keep in mind, at the end of the day, you still need some security for that lender to feel comfortable with what you're doing. And since the industry is in such disarray at this point in time, you have an ever-increasing demand from a consumer that, you know, you have new adopters coming into the space, yet you have this absolute mess when it comes to the financing environment. So you have to, you know, identify lenders that are not looking to, and I come from banking, and, you know, you have that, you know, the usurious rates and the, you know, real grave, you know, people that are literally dancing on people's graves trying to lend to own. And that's what we're seeing right now. We see deals being done that in a normal traditional industry just would not be, you know, structured in that manner. So it's a lot to take in there, Gary. But
I think you bring up right a really good point, Urban. I think that in a traditional industry, and this is where I may completely differ from this headline as far as my take on this headline. In a traditional industry, some of this debt would be, we would absolutely be named vulture capitalism, right? And that's what we saw during the bubble of the internet, right? During the just after the 2008 housing crisis. And so the in my opinion, the ringing of the bell that debt financing is here and therefore it's more traditional. If you look at the actual debt deals, and I know the deal that you referred to before, and it absolutely crushed that company. And so I think there's a cautionary tale here. Yes, true private equity and or debt financing that is at a reasonable rate of the ratio of the value and the growth of the company is good for an industry, and it's going to allow the supply chain of this industry to be more traditional. I don't believe this particular deal is an example of that. And so I think that we really have to be careful as executives in an industry that we have had to bob and weave and really understand, really get above the noise in order to succeed, even as far as we have just the last 5 or 6 months. It's really important that the industry understands that debt has always been there. It's always been onerous. It will crush you if you're not very careful. And this doesn't mean that there's a capital rush on the way. It does mean, though, that there are more players in the market, and therefore the buyer has to be more aware than ever before. I hope you think that's fair, Urban, but I don't think it, like I said, I don't think it's the woo-hoo that everybody thought it was when the headline came out.
No. And it's, again, when you're literally in the thick of it in our industry, you understand, right?
Right.
From an outside perspective and people looking in, you know, trying to figure out, you know, what does this mean for the industry? Again, usurious rates are always usurious rates, but everything is exacerbated as a result of COVID.
That's
so you
exactly
have
right.
These headlines that, you know, create a buzz and a stir. But again, I truly hope and believe that we'll get through this in the coming months. Certainly within 2021, things will normalize. The actual, you know, equity markets will open back up again. But when it comes to the debt component, you know, again, that headline for this industry at the end of the day, you know, you know, a good company is going to be able to get better terms. But in today's market, there's, you know, the uncertainty is just palpable for everyone. That's the reason that gold is flirting with 2000. You know, it's just flight to safety.
That's a really
time,
good point.
You know, if you put out any money, it's obviously going to be expensive money. That's it.
Yep.
Well, we're going to move on to our next headline. Forbes had published U.S. cannabis stocks, a good investment in a bad economy. You know, as we were just talking about all the uncertainty with COVID, so taking into all the different factors that are at play in the current economy, how would you characterize the state of investment in the cannabis industry in the U.S. right now?
I think, listen, we just, we just came off of our board meeting yesterday. We're on the phone with our investors probably at least, if not 3-4 times a month. Right. So, I think that the current environment for investment in the cannabis industry is twofold. One, I think it's a great time to invest in the cannabis industry because after 6 months of what has been happening, all the entrepreneurs on the entrepreneurial side, right, as an operating executive of a venture-backed firm, we have two major companies behind us. One is a private cannabis-specific fund, and one is a gigantic publicly traded venture capital fund, and which is actually a really good position for us because the private market fund is really interested and really helps us be efficient in cash management, really helps us be efficient in making sure that we're making the right decisions. And it really, the investment environment for the true entrepreneur, I think the operating entrepreneur, in my opinion right now, is a good one because it means that you're interacting with your investors often. And if you're doing it well, then they're good interactions and you're always learning. No matter how much experience you could possibly have, you're always learning, especially in an industry that forces you to be efficient and nimble like this. And then the public, I think the public part, the public enterprise that invests in us really helps us maintain and increase the sophistication in how we look at our modeling, our cost of, the headcount cost and the resource cost of the company itself, and every dollar in to every dollar out and being able to track that. And so I think that from the original question, if investors are willing to do the work with the companies they invest in, there's a heck of a lot of opportunity out there because everybody's running really lean. Everybody's really, the valuations are really smart right now. And everybody is prepared for 2021 to be an explosive growth year for us. Urban, I think, I don't know what you think about that, but.
Yeah, no, again, this COVID scenario has just shown a spotlight on execution. And unless you have the ability to, again, do workarounds, be nimble, pivot quickly, like everyone else, we had to, tragically lay off people when all of this hit. Vendors weren't paying, bills were not being paid by anyone across the board. A lot of companies are, going out of business as we speak. It's a battle of attrition. So we see this period as if you can survive this. Again, we all know the demand is there, right? But it's navigating these months, and we truly believe, and that Forbes article speaks to that, where our analysis of the way that we're looking at the 2.0 aspects of the industry is, if you look at what happened with the pets.com, right? The insane valuations, the subsequent crash, that was still where Amazon, PayPal, subsequently Google, Facebook, on and on and on. This is the inflection point, we believe, also then coupled with the legal climate being, not only in the North American realm, but on a global basis. I mean, I don't know how much you're following what's happening with the United Nations and the WHO voting on most likely not removing it, but descheduling or rescheduling the plant and ironically taking data from North America. That's so we correct, believe right. that Europe is going to be opening up, but that also will cause additional investors to most likely feel more comfortable of coming in. So you have more buyers than sellers, stocks go up, right? But ultimately, the companies that are surviving this and are now have all sharpened their pencils towards getting to profitability, including ourselves. We're about a month and a half from profitability, or at least at a break even. Certainly by year end, we will be at a profitable level. That shows the quality of that 2.0 cycle. You're going to have more buyers coming in. And I truly believe, for what you said, 2021 will be a real, real uplift for the cannabis stocks again, with real companies, with real fundamentals.
Yeah, and I think just to continue on that for a second, I also think, and I think the analogy of the apartments.com or pets.com was a really good analogy because if you remember back then when Facebook came out, when Google, subsequently Google came out, the investment level actually increased by tenfold, right? There were 1,000 companies back then all raising $10 million apiece. But now you had one company raising $1 billion, right? And I think what we're also in the background, one of the reasons Forbes wrote that article, you know, I don't know if anybody's watched the stock market, the cannabis specific stock market over the last few days, but it's been pretty volatile because there's a lot of rumor about big names who are finally, you know, they're finally scratching, you know, they're cutting the checks and getting ready to dust off their playbooks and bring them into the industry. And so I do think that we have the capability of coming out of this and making that statement true. I don't think that it's necessarily true today, but it's absolutely true, I think, for the public market investor that's looking over the next couple of years.
Yep, it's a good entry point.
Right. That's been kind of an underlying theme with pretty much everyone we've interviewed the past couple of weeks, is just everybody's in survival mode. It's just trying to get through this patch.
But I think actually, Heather, I think that's a good point. And Urban started the conversation with, you know, it's not only the pivoting and being in survival mode, but whilst being survival-esque efficient, knowing how to grow your revenue capabilities and to diversify those revenue streams. So it's not only being, you know, survival of your resource pool and your cash, but you still need to show the capability of growing the industry, growing your company in this environment.
Right. Yep. And if you're stuck home with two little kids, you have to be even more efficient.
Yes.
But on the flip side, what do you think as far as what should investors be looking at when they're thinking about, you know, evaluating whether or not to jump into the space?
That's just, again, such an open-ended question, and is subject to, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you got to believe that management and you betting on the jockey has always been, you know, how I've been looking at things. But with this industry, it's also the ability to gauge the risk. And if you want exposure to the industry and looking at what happened with the people that were too aggressive, they tried the multi-state operator model that, again, people just plowed so much money into certain catchphrases and buzzwords that made the stock go up at that juncture. But looking at the execution of how did these operators actually attack being able to do this in a multi-state, you know, environment when you don't have the efficiencies of being able to cross state lines. It never made sense to us. We've always focused on California. It's the fifth largest economy in the world. It is definitely the biggest cannabis market in the world. And all of the VC deals that I've placed from banking, they always said, give me one market. Show me that you can do this in one place before you go somewhere else. So that is how we're looking at it. But what I'm seeing now emerging is, since most likely Arizona is going to go wreck, you have all of these contiguous states on the West Coast. And I've read and heard a lot of noise about the possibility of opening up commerce between those states, allowing some efficiencies. But people that did this on an East West Coast level, you know, it's not there yet. It's not ripe yet. But identifying the vertical that you want to be exposed to in this market, obviously, we believe that distribution is key to it. And we believe that we're a solid investment as a result of that, you know, formula. But other people still don't want to touch the plant, right? Where you have new frontier.
Right.
You are an enabler in a sense, but you are a data play at the end of the day. So it's looking at your own risk profile and discerning where you want to be in all of that.
Yeah, and I think that was a good point, Urban. I think that for New Frontier Data, the advice we give, you know, investors are a large amount of our audience, right? A large amount of our clients are institutional and or private office investors. Always, you know, you look at the efficiency of the business, you look at their intersection with that, whatever supply chain it may be, right? Whether as Urban talked about, looking at California and looking at every part of that supply chain and being able to be part of that supply chain. One of the other things I think is really important for investors right now is that we know enough about the consumer and the consumer demand, where 4 years ago we didn't. 4 years ago, we all thought and we knew that there are a lot of consumers out there, right? Now we have actual scientific data. We have real information and data and insights backing it. But understanding where the consumer is going to be, right, and where you want to be with that consumer is going to be important for investors. As far as a risk threshold, I think some of the skittishness of touching the plant or not touching the plant has eroded a bit. But I still think there's a huge institutional reluctance to do anything that's federally illegal. And so the risk factor is always going to be based on is always going to be based on what their risk portfolio needs to look like or their risk behavior needs to look like. But also, as Urban said, betting on the jockey, right? The executive team has to be able to execute. The executive team, we had a lot of people in 1.0 that came from, you know, oil and gas or wine and spirits or other industries that while may look like something like this industry, once you get into the industry and you understand the X factor here, that there isn't any interstate commerce, that every single marketplace is a microcosm of a larger marketplace. We still have to address the larger marketplace, but we have to address it 41 times, right? 33 times recreate or 33 times medical and rec, 47 times when you add in CBD. All of those things cause inefficiency and all of those things cause a number of things to work in order for it to work. And that's where that risk piece really comes in. Sorry, it's a long answer, but it's an open-ended question, and it's actually not an easy question to answer in an industry like this.
Yeah. On our last episode, we talked about, you know, the Canadian market and its beginning and how there was just so much opportunity and it was just kind of a grab for opportunity and people just wanted to get the biggest footprint. And that is legally nationally. And their complaints looking back were saying you didn't have to be everything to everybody and have if someone were a little more focused on what they were doing in one particular part of the supply chain and just focus on one vertical and stop trying to take over everything.
Yeah.
Urban, what do you think? I actually think Canada is almost the reason we saw the MSO in the US, right? Because it was federally legal in Canada, even though it had different provinces. So people thought, okay, well, we might be able to do multi-state. But at the end of the day, and back to one of my original points, the consumer base in Canada is so small.
Yeah.
That there was so much money thrown at it that there was no possible way for it to ever be efficient because there wasn't enough consumers to justify $13 billion in 1 year of infrastructure investment.
Yeah. No, it's always been interesting to me to look at, you know, the Canadian stocks, the ones that were based in Canada and the larger ones that were then as a result of that being able to be listed on NYSE or NASDAQ. And part of their pitch is the export, which to me, it boggles the mind that a fully burdened, you know, ingrown cannabis, but just because it has Health Canada on stamped on it, you can now sell this in Germany and in Israel. But as this industry matures on a global basis, who would want to buy hothouse weed from Canada?
That's exactly right.
No sense to me. And again, California and the California market is larger than all of Canada. So, you know, the premiums that we saw up there, I think it was, you know, at the end of the day, it was the being able to access the capital markets and, you know, with the CSE, you know, it enabled people to raise a whole lot of money. But, you know, so many of those operators have now subsequently failed or are about to fail or have certainly, you know, taken money at levels that, you know, it was ridiculous, frankly.
Yeah, and I do think though that the one part of this industry in the US in each individual market that creates almost the opportunity, Urban, that you are really capitalizing on, is that the investors really haven't invested in the actual infrastructure of the supply chain. They've gotten each individual piece, right? Or you may have a couple of vertically integrated, and they think that for their particular supply chain, that works. But as a market, right, even in California, the ability to exchange and intercompany, to do intercompany commerce within different parts of the supply chain, it's just outrageously difficult. And investors in the regulatory bodies really need to look at how to make that, California's a great example of how to make that one market, which is the biggest market. Let's make that one market really hyper-efficient.
Yeah. Right?
And hyper-profitable and hyper-consumer focused. And then Colorado can go back and retrofit, and Nevada can go back and retrofit, and Oregon can do the same. Maybe by then the federal government will understand that there is money to be made here, and that there's a legal way to do this without being an advocate of drug use, and the worry that the House and our House of Representatives have. But anyway, that's something that the investors really need to be looking at.
Yep.
Well, we're almost out of time, so I want to wrap it with one last question for you both, and I'll start with Urban. What do you anticipate to be one of the biggest changes in the industry moving into cannabis 2.0?
I think, again, the companies that survive this, the ones that we can truly call the 2.0 companies, are all, again, it's going to come down to execution. You're going to have to adhere to your business plan and so on and so forth. But the ones that have grown up now through this COVID period are going to be companies that, you can actually evaluate similarly to other industries and other companies. I think we're through the irrational exuberance part of it. Investors no longer buy into those crazy valuations. So I see the maturity of the market finally getting there, but we're all still going to be subject to, the legal climate. Not only in the individual states, but obviously on the federal level. But that's where I see additional buyers coming into the space, because I think that there's going to be such an enormous amount of news flow towards companies that are now actually executing, showing real EBITDA, showing the ability to have survived this period. You can basically tackle anything, right? Even the BCC. It's something that you end up growing up very, very quickly during this period. So I think obviously that the election is going to be, a huge, huge catalyst. I think post-election, this is going to be, it's going to be a screaming market. It's going to go straight up.
I couldn't agree more. I think that the political environment in the United States has provided so much confusion. And then when you add that to the equity market shutting down last year, as Urban spoke about, and the COVID-19 pandemic this year, the capabilities of companies to navigate this is going to be the badge of honor that 2000 was for those of us that were in the internet. And so if you get through it, you're going to be smart enough that you don't need to write your own ticket, because you're going to have already done it, and you're going to have done it with blood, sweat, and tears, right? But then when you do actually go out there to raise, and you're going to raise because you actually need it for growth capital, you don't need it to pay payroll, that is when we're going to see a real mature, that's when debt financing is really going to come into this market, because that's going to be debt that somebody can pay back and doesn't have to convert, right? And you can use that truly for cash management, for growth, for opportunistic acquisitions, for all the things that we wanted to do, that 2 years ago, that we will now be capable of doing, because as Urban has pointed out, political environment will come around for us, the banking environment and legality will come around for us, and therefore the capital markets and the debt financing will come around for us.
Agreed.
Awesome. Well, cool. We're going to leave it there today. Thank you guys so much for joining us. And thank you to our listeners for joining us at CannaWeek. Please be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast. You can find these news stories and more on New Frontier Data's Cannabis Insights Daily. I'm your host, Heather Wickline, and I'll see you next time. New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.